Wondering if you should stay in Illinois or move out of state? Get your copy of Scott Tucker's book, Escape Illinois, Should I Stay or Should I Go? Get your complimentary copy at retirementdakota.com.
Investment advisory services are made available through AE Wealth Management, LLC, a registered investment advisor.
This week, the Rascals mints about the appearances that Bill and Hillary Clinton put out, how little George Lucas fought for his museum, and the constant violence in Chicago.
Today is Friday. It's the 1st of July, 2016. This is John Williams, and this is the Mincing Rascals, our weekly podcast, part of which you can hear Saturday afternoons on WGN Radio at 1:30. And now, here is our cast of Eric Zorn.
Yes, I'm Eric Zorn. I'm the beloved Tribune columnist. You can read me Wednesdays, Fridays, and Sundays in the print editions of the Tribune and just about every day online. So
we're normally joined in this by Steve Bertrand, who is not with us today, and Kristen McQuarrie, Bertrand from WGN Radio. Kristen is an editorial writer for the Chicago Tribune.
And she just poked her head into my office and said, oh, my God, I've got deadlines and I can't make it. So
she'd rather write.
I said priorities, Kristen. Get your priorities in order. She was up, you know, she was up really early this morning. She was guest hosting on the Right Wing Talk Radio. So,
no kidding. Does she do a little bit of that?
She does. She's really good. I think, you know, I mean, she's not here, so I can say this about her, but I think she's excellent on electronic media.
Well, I think she is. I think she's a rising star in the Chicago media landscape.
Yeah, but too bad about her opinions.
Well, you know, I think.
If only she used her power for good. But.
Makes her just that much more attractive and appealing is that she's leans a little right, but she's very accommodating to those of us on the left. Were there more people like her in Springfield and Washington, D.C., we might not even have a podcast, Eric. We wouldn't be standing here.
Well, she's very thoughtful. And, you know,
well, that's
and,
what and,
and it's
say.
Always fun to disagree with her because she's thoughtful and informed. And enough
here,
about her. She's not even here.
Let's you and I break
nuts
the mold.
Let's talk about
that. We will start today just because it's maybe the most topical thing today, the 1st of July, and that is that former President Bill Clinton got on a plane just to have a friendly chat with Attorney General Loretta Lynch, even as her office was investigating his wife's use of her email server. What was he thinking? Now, Loretta Lynch has been forced to say, okay, I'm not going to recuse myself, but I am going to accept whatever the findings are of the FBI and the career prosecutors in this case. If they recommend that we go forward with this, then I will. And if they say no, I won't, but I'm not going to weigh in on it. That was probably what was going to happen anyway. Now her hand is forced, and the optics of this are terrible. The Clintons sometimes cannot get out of their own way, Eric.
Well, that's true. My guess is that they probably didn't talk about the case. Certainly, she said they didn't, and he indicated that they didn't talk about the case, and it would be bizarre if they had. I think what he was probably thinking was that, well, he could go and make sort of a friendly visit to her that no one would know about, because it's not, you know, I don't know exactly how this came out that this happened, because it wasn't like this was a scheduled meeting. He apparently just walked over to her airplane, and he thought that he would talk to her and kind of butter her up a little bit, and that would be that. Obviously, what has happened here is if there was ever any chance that Loretta Lynch was going to put her thumb on the scale in favor of Hillary Clinton, that chance is gone now.
Exactly.
He totally ruined that, and he made it more awkward for them not to file charges.
If they didn't talk about the case, and I think you're right. I don't think she's a liar. In fact, she's there in part because she's not super partisan, but let's assume that they're both telling the truth about this. They didn't talk about the case, but it is sort of softening up the jury, if you will, if he goes over there and says, hey, let's talk about our grandkids. And on some level, he's just trying to make the Clintons seem a little more pleasant.
Yeah.
Target. I mean,
that's
just as heavy handed as presenting evidence. It's still a manipulation. You should not do that.
Yeah, obviously, you shouldn't have done it. The news, of course, this morning is that Loretta Lynch has recused herself and has said that she's not going to be part of this decision, which is, I think, fair. And
what is he thinking? He's got a good political ear.
No one's going to know. That's what he's thinking. What was he thinking when he fooled around with Monica Lewinsky? He's thinking no one's going to find out.
Boy, I thought he was smarter than that these days. And by the way, this notion, just if you think that the Clintons are part of an elite class, this notion that my airplane is over by your airplane, and then I'll walk over to your airplane and ask if you, what, have any gray poupons?
John, doesn't this happen to you? Come on, isn't like your when your private jet is parked out of Midway and you see another person's private jet?
And go, hey, pull over, yeah. That's Cindy. Cindy, hi, hold on. And then I'm running across the tarmac. Good Lord. And then you think nobody's going to notice? Your Bill Clinton satellites are watching you. Are you kidding me?
Yeah.
What a dope.
Well, you know, I the people who really know about how the law works here keep saying that there's probably not going to be any indictment of Hillary Clinton. But let's play that out, though. What if she is indicted? What happens then? Who steps in? I think you can't run a candidate for president who's under indictment.
Oh, Lord, yes, you can.
Oh,
against this candidate, you can. I was thinking about that, though, Eric. My God, really does torpedo her candidacy. She's actually had a little uptick. She's up double digits in many polls this week. And then this happens. Thank you very little, Bill. But, I mean, yeah, you can run her. I would not. What are you going to do? Run?
Joe Biden?
Sure.
Uncle Joe. Everybody likes him.
You know, wouldn't it be funny if the Democrats did the same switcheroo that some people still think that the Republicans are going to try?
So it ends up being like Biden against Romney or something?
Yeah. Rubio's going to run for Senate now, I guess. So there goes that. I think it's going to be both candidates running right through the conventions into November. And then we'll see if we have our own Brexit or not. That's just the way that's going to go. Let's talk a little bit about the Benghazi report. Speaking of Hillary Clinton, the Chicago Tribune editorialized that while there's no bombshell here, it looks really bad for Hillary Clinton.
There's a little bit of similarity with this Bill Clinton and Loretta Lynch thing, isn't there? I mean, it's like the appearances are bad. There wasn't a big smoking gun in this Benghazi report. There wasn't any. There was no suggestion in there. And this has been one of the big things, was that if she had acted somehow differently or if she had acted more responsibly, that those victims would have been saved there. Whatever malfeasance there was about security really wasn't an active decision that she had made. On the other hand, there's this business about how this was presented to the public afterwards. And again, you got to think, what are these people thinking? When I think back on this, was September 11th of 2012, I think was the date, right? You know, 2 months before the election, a little bit less. And this compound, this diplomatic compound is overrun by a violent horde and four Americans are killed. Why do you have to try to spin that as related to a video as opposed to being a terrorist act? I just don't understand what the political calculation was. Why anybody thought that was going to change any votes? I mean, clearly they weren't prepared for that attack. Clearly it was something that happened. So whether it was, and I actually agree with what Hillary Clinton's been quoted as saying. It's like, after the fact, after this compound has been overrun by armed people, that there was not enough security, what difference does it make what the motivation was of the people who were attacking the compound? But all of that gets lost in the fact that they were trying to spin it one way rather than just be straight with people.
I'm a little surprised, though, that she gets the pass about preparedness. I mean, the State Department does oversee this somewhat. They had reached out to State or the Department of Defense previously, but at the end of the day, it was the Department of State or Department of Defense reached back out to that outpost in Benghazi and said, do you need more security? Then they sort of said, oh, we'll be fine. But previously they had asked for more armaments. It just seems to me like whatever the timeline is, once the firing started or at 24 hours before, right, there's nothing Hillary Clinton or the Department of Defense could have done that quickly to save them. But what about in the months leading up to that?
Right.
Wasn't that their job to oversee that?
Well, Ambassador Stevens was a good friend of hers, and he wasn't just any old ambassador. They were friends, and so the idea that she deliberately downplayed his security requests, I mean, how many there are several hundred diplomatic outposts around the world for the U.S. that the State Department is managing. And I don't think that Hillary Clinton is looking at each thing as it comes through and signing off on various requests for things like that.
She deputizes
people to do
but
that.
But, well, the buck stops there. And in hindsight, if you had to guess where do we need to be most careful, you know, that's a lot more significant than, I don't know, it's hard to predict anymore where the next bomb's going to go off. But, I mean, you would have guessed that should have been on the top of somebody's priority
right.
list.
Right. Well, the question with all these things, the question comes down to judgment, right? And you have to say, does Hillary Clinton, and this is what our editorial got at and what people are asking themselves, does Hillary Clinton have the judgment, the good judgment to be president of the United States? And, you know, the answer may be, well, ideally you'd want someone with who has shown better judgment. But in the real world, you've got a choice between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump and all that.
Oh, yeah, that's – well, but did not the Tribune also sort of question her honesty? Remember, your editorial also pointed out that Hillary sent an email to her daughter saying one thing, and then the talking points for Susan Rice the next day were something different.
Well, she didn't write the talking points. The CIA wrote the talking points.
Still, it sounds like Hillary Clinton knew one thing and said
right.
that to her family and then said something else to the world.
Right. I think that comes through in this report. The question is how big a deal is that when you look at the, you know, the grand scope of things, when you look at the character and honesty and fitness for office of both.
Yeah, but don't
these
you
candidates.
See a trend here then? So look at the sure. last two conversations we've had. The Clintons are always a little bit above the rest of us, aren't they? They don't have to play by our rules. They've been getting away with it for years. Lord knows they're smart, but their integrity is a little questionable at times.
It is, but Donald Trump is a flim-flam man. I mean, you know, this is the
we
thing.
We can talk about Trump, but let's at least the Clintons own this.
I think we should, and I think, you know, this is obviously not an election between two almost perfect candidates or even ideal candidates for their own parties. This is, you know, some of this Clinton stuff was why I was immediately so big on Barack Obama in 2008, because I just, this all the Clinton, all the Michigas that comes with the Clintons and their the way they do things, the way they talk about things, I just didn't want to relive that. And I have had some of those same reservations when she started running this time.
Like, oh, yeah, I wish she was not the candidate. Absolutely.
Do we wish there was somebody else who was
there? Is. Well, I don't know who it is, and I don't think it's Joe Biden, although I think Joe Biden could have won. Frankly, I would vote for a jar of olives before I would vote for Donald Trump, and I think a jar of olives could give him a pretty fair run. I still hope that the story of Trump is going to be remembered as a man who just sort of imploded, you know, on the weight of his own hubris, that he just that he just said one damn too many crazy things. And even Hillary Clinton beat him that year.
We'll see. I mean, his appeal clearly is that he believes he has simple answers to really complicated questions. And he says it over and over again. And people want to believe that. That is the bear. And then when I say he's a flim-flam man, I mean, this is a classic confidence game that he's running in the way. That's what a con man does, right? He says, I've got easy way for you to make money. This is simple for you. I'm gonna, you know, this business with trade, his ideas on trade are mind-blowingly bizarre.
I sent an email to Steve Chapman, your colleague, this week, and said, thank you for explaining to those of us who sometimes have to point out Trump's flaws how wildly fictional his view of world economics is.
Steve Chapman has flowered under the Trump. I mean, he's always been a great columnist. I've always really admired Steve, professionally and personally. He's a great guy. Donald Trump has just brought out the absolute best in him. If you're not reading Steve Chapman, you know, subscribe to him online or whatever, search for him. But his stuff on Trump.
Well,
is
and there was no vitriol. I can't get out of my way of my own hatred of what Trump is and represents. But he was just saying, okay, here's what he said. Here's the truth about that. NAFTA, you know, Europe, Brexit, all of that. And he said, here's just how that stuff is categorically, whimsically not true. And it was very, very helpful. Just as a for instance, he said, you know, NAFTA, that was terrible. We're dying under NAFTA. Trade is actually, manufacturing is up in the United States since NAFTA. We need an open border like that so we can export, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And import, for that matter.
Yeah, I mean, it's he makes a great case, Steve does, and yes, well, we're complimenting all my colleagues.
Let's talk about Melody Hobson. I don't think we'll be complimenting her right now. She said in the Chicago Tribune this week that she is devastated that her husband's museum isn't going to happen here. What happened to the Lucas? What was it? Artsy Fartsy Museum?
The Lucas Museum of Narrative Arts.
Narrative Arts, yeah. But what happened to that?
What happened?
Well, why did it? Why is it not going to happen in Chicago?
It's not going to happen in Chicago because the location right on the lakefront violated the law, essentially, that said that that land belongs to the public and is meant to be used for public purposes and not.
Could they have made a way for the Lucas Museum to happen here?
I don't know, because we never really heard from George Lucas himself about what his priorities were and why it had to be there. Now, the mayor made the point that you want a museum on the museum campus. I am not someone who was aghast at the very idea. It is a parking lot now. It'll always be a parking lot until something else is built there. And it's between McCormick Place and Soldier Field, which is not exactly a wonderful meadow where people are hanging out. So it seemed like a decent use of that land. The guy was going to give us $750 million to build it. And it was going to create jobs, a bunch of temporary construction jobs and some long-term museum jobs. And I don't think that it would have done violence to our lakefront the way the Friends of the Parks did. The design, my wife and I were talking about this, she really hated the design. She thought it looked like, a snowball that had plopped onto the lakefront or something. That really had turned her off to it. I feel like what really happened here was that the mayor didn't run it well, didn't run the campaign well, and George Lucas himself didn't get us excited about it. It seemed like I'm cleaning out my attic and I want a place to put my stuff. Can I put it on your lakefront? That's kind of how it felt.
Yeah.
I mean, it wasn't that, but that's kind of how it felt. They never really made the case. They never built the excitement. You'd ask anybody what exactly was going to be in that museum.
That's a huge problem. Nobody ever really understood what it
Rockwells,
was.
Yeah, some R2-D2s. I mean, what was going to be there that was going to draw people from all
Don't know. Don't know. And I think you're right, too. Not only did we not know what it was.
I got a prediction for you, though, John. They're going to open this museum in San Francisco or somewhere,
right,
and it's going to be really cool. And we're all going to go like, that would have been kind of nice here.
You know, I was wondering about that, too. I thought, are we going to regret that we didn't get it? And I thought, well, we still have a planetarium and an aquarium and an art museum and a science and industry museum right on the lake. You know, I mean, it's not like we're Peoria. And by the way, I got friends in Peoria and family, love Peoria, but you're not San Francisco and you're not Chicago. We'll be fine without it. You know, it's not the only museum in the world, and we missed this one.
It's not, and you do wish that Lucas had taken, taken a step back across Lakeshore Drive. You could still be ostensibly part of the museum campus without being right on the lake, that there maybe were some other solutions to this.
Well, did he do a little tour? I mean, if you were George Lucas and you really wanted this to happen, how could you have made it happen? If you really want to have it on the lake, how do you do that? And if you really want it to happen in Chicago, how flexible should you be ready and willing to be? And he didn't, I don't recall him popping up on Michigan Avenue and, you know, doing the sort of things that he should do as an advocate for his own project. Did he spend a lot of time in Chicago shaking hands?
None, as far as I know.
Did he do a PowerPoint presentation for the City Club or something like that? I don't remember that happening.
No, he never built the kind of and that's the kind of thing that would have built some of the public pressure that might have had the mayor try to hang on or to maybe, you know, improvise a little bit. There was a spot, Blair Kamen, our architecture critic, suggested that right across Lakeshore Drive, right near all that, you could have, there's some ripe land over there to build on, and you could have connected the other museums with a tram, you know, so that it's, you know, so you could get back and forth easily. Yeah. If you were, you know, so you didn't have to like park your car again to go there, and maybe they could have hooked it up with some public transportation, and it'd be a fine place for a museum. And I guess you want the view, but maybe you could have built it up a little bit so you could see out onto the water.
Yeah, that could happen.
It just seemed like they weren't thinking all that creatively and or collaboratively, and Lucas didn't do the sell job that he needed to do.
What do you think of this statistic that Chicago is on a pace right now to have an Orlando every month? And here we are recording this on the beginning of the 4th of July weekend. In, you know, days, we'll know how good or bad it was. But this is at least looking 6 years back, and 6 years ago wasn't very good. This is eclipsing far and away the most violent summer, and June the most violent month we've seen in a long time. I almost, if I were the police chief or the mayor or somebody, you know, you almost want to throw your hands up to the west and south sides or wherever the next shootings are going to occur and just say, you know what, you guys have at it, fine. I'm not going to put my people in harm's way. Clearly, we can't, you know, get in front of the bullets. We can only pick up after the fact and then try and find the people that did it. So fine, if the community can't, if the families can't, if the thugs can't figure it out, I give up. I quit trying.
Yeah, of course, the problem with that is not if the gangbangers were just killing each other, you might have a little bit more acceptance of a thought like that, but there, you know, people are hitting the crossfire all the time by this, and it's really horrible. Before we began taping this podcast, I forwarded you the Tribune Alert newsletter or email blast. There were 24 shootings in the last 24 hours in Chicago, which is more than 10, the 10 shootings a day that inspired the Tribune to do a story for, in this Sunday's paper. It's going to be my recommendation, but I think I'll just get out in front of it right now. It's called 10 Shootings a Day, Complex Causes of Chicago's Spiking Violence. It's going to be a big story by Annie Sweeney and Jeremy Gorner, and it's already online. And it talks about how, you know, halfway through this year, homicides are up 49% in the city, we're up to 312 already. These are levels that we haven't seen since the late 90s.
Well, let me read a line from it. About 416 people were killed or wounded in 333 shootings in June, a sharp spike from last June, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, I mean, it goes on and on. It talks about how two of the city's most historically violent districts, Harrison and Englewood, account for a fourth of the homicides and shootings. And that basically they're saying that what is happening here is what's happening. There's a number of factors, but one of them is that these huge street gangs that we remember hearing about, you know, the Black Peastone Nation and the Gangster Disciples and so on, they have broken up into what they call cliques of really small factions that fight each other. So you'll have, you know, people who used to be under the same gang umbrella who now live close to each other and are trying to kill each other all the time. I heard a very interesting report on Channel 11 the other night where a guy was talking about how social media has played into this. Social media accelerates violence and anger, that the kind of, you know, the taunting and insults that you might get on the street are now broadcast to the world on social media. And so the demand for you to respond, to, you know, take revenge on someone who disses you, becomes greater. So that these social media posts and these videos that these guys are creating, mostly guys, are fueling this violence. So they also talked about, you know, the question as to whether the police are standing down for one reason or another. Dean Angelo gave a speech, the Fraternal Order of Police head, on Tuesday, where he said street stops were down by 150,000 so far this year. It's 150,000 people the police did not stop, did not search, did not question. And he blamed that, he said that the real problem is not the Ferguson effect, you know, not that they're afraid of being caught on video or having some sort of altercation in which they lose their jobs or they're fine, but it has to do with the paperwork they've got to fill out.
Hmm.
That the you know, because of some consent decrees that, with the ACLU and so on, that they've got to, you know, fill out extensive reports on all these street stops in order to detect whether there's racial disparities in the people that are deciding to stop. So.
The attitude in Minneapolis, it's the same sort of thing. Arrests and stops are way down, even though you sense the violence ratcheting up. And it is the Ferguson effect. They said, you know what, we can't win. We do our job, we get caught on video, we get in trouble anyway. So we're just going to kind of lay back and show up when and where we have to. We're going to be a lot less interventionist.
I hold out some hope for the body camera solution,
yeah,
to this.
I don't. Well, I do both, Eric. I see the potential for it's good, but like everything, I think, boy, I can already see the problems coming with it.
One of the things that police will tell you, police officers will tell you, is that some of these videos that are shot by citizens with their phones are out of context.
Mm-hmm.
And so you don't see what leads up to it, what the precipitating events are, what might make the officer fear for his life or his safety and so on. Now, I don't know how true all that is, but certainly having a body cam that would show these interactions from the beginning to the end, I think will be helpful. And I think that when citizens know that they are being recorded, they will be less likely, I think, to, first of all, to file false complaints.
Yeah, sure.
And perhaps also they'll be less likely to try to start trouble with these officers. I mean, I don't know what other solution you would have to this problem.
No.
Have community meetings and softball games and so on to try to make the community and the police department have a tighter bond, but I don't know that those kind of solutions are going to work any better than some of these technological ones.
Well, let's go with that, and now let's go to our recommendation part of the show. Steve Bertrand, what's your... Oh, never mind.
Kristen McCrory, last time she was on and I wasn't here, she recommended that you go online and read past editions of my column.
I don't remember it that way.
I'll recommend that for her again.
I don't mind us being self-serving, but 2 weeks in a row, you're doubling down, Eric. That's amazing.
Well, you know, here's the thing. There is an editorial this morning. I don't think Kristen wrote it, but I know that she kind of inspired it. You know, these editorials, they have a life of their own. But it talks about the stopgap budget that was passed in Springfield. We didn't touch on that, but basically points out that this is really a pretty pathetic thing that's happened in Springfield. And they're all patting themselves on the back for coming to some agreement, which they did on the last day of the fiscal year in which they had no budget whatsoever. And it only extends things for 6 months. It has no tax increases, so we're going to keep accumulating debt. And there's no...
Well, we're $7 billion short then.
Or $8 billion. So they put it off for 6 months. And this editorial was strongly written, and it was wagging its finger at the legislature for not getting it done. My column on the Facing page had some of the same message, but I'm saying that we have a budget process that's very complicated, even without Governor Rauner's turnaround agenda items, that you can see how the various constituencies were arguing about funding for schools in Chicago. So you've got these geographical, you've got these partisan, you've got these racial ethnic divisions and trying to get a budget together to make the basic decision about what should government do and how should we pay for it. And when you throw these other things on there, like workers' comp reform or changing the way legislative maps are drawn, or pension changes, that kind of thing. You throw those into the mix, you make it incredibly complicated to impossible. So I think that Governor Rauner has to pull those off the table and get the budget done. And then he can start making his case for changes in workers' comp and changes in the way, you know, unions get to negotiate on the local level and things mm-hmm. like that. He's got to make those cases, but you can't govern by ultimatum anyway.
So really that's your recommendation? Read your... column.
Read my column, read our editorial. But actually, my real recommendation is to go online and read or go buy yourself a Sunday paper and read this piece by Annie Sweeney and Jeremy Gorner, 10 Shootings a Day, Complex Causes of Chicago's Spiking Violence. It really puts the whole thing into perspective. It's not a happy story. It's not one of those feel-good
no.
stories.
No, for the 4th of July, dog. Enjoy your weekend.
Happy
yeah.
fireworks.
Yeah, I think I'll do recipes for hot dogs and ice cream. Actually, my recommendations are two. I've been saying this for the last couple of weeks, but I finished last night or the night before the fifth installment of the O.J. Simpson 30 on 30 series, Made in America, O.J. Simpson. It's just remarkable. I mean, the idea, did O.J. do it or not, is so beside the point in this. It's so bigger than that. So much bigger than that.
Do you know if it's streaming, John? Is that I know it's on ESPN, and I want to start watching it from the beginning, but I can't.
On demand is how we've been watching it, and there are so many ABC ESPN platforms that my guess is if you click around or surf around, you should be able to find it. You haven't missed the boat on this, trust me.
I know it's on the ESPN app.
On the ESPN app?
Yeah, because I've watched it on my phone on the ESPN app.
Oh. Good news, yeah. Thank you, Kristen, because it's a civics lesson, and everybody should watch it. One other civics lesson I'm going to recommend I'm going to be on stage. Maybe you can help me with this too, Kristen. August 13th, 10 a.m. at the MAC, the theater at the College of DuPage. Tickets for my conversation with Teddy Roosevelt. Oh, that he were a candidate right now. Are on sale at WGNradio.com/events. WGNradio.com/events. As we speak, the show's about half sold out. There's still tickets available. And it's so fun. It's so funny. It's such a remarkable performance by this TR guy I interview on stage. And so that wraps it up for this edition of the Mincing Rascals. I'm John Williams. Thank you, Eric Zorn. Nice to chat with you. I kind of enjoy the one-on-one feel of it, too.
Who needs those other rascals anyway? You don't
really. We get to talk more. It's awesome. Thank you, Kristen Decker, our producer, who helps us, as you can tell, in many ways. And Bob Ferguson, our engineer, will drop another pod on you next week.
Subscribe to the Mincing Rascals podcast on iTunes or the Google Play Music Store or wherever fine podcasts are downloaded. You can also listen online on the WGN Plus app or WGNplus.com. The Mincing Rascals podcast is a presentation of the WGN Plus podcast network. You can also catch highlights every Saturday from 1:30 to 2 p.m. on The John Williams Show on WGN Radio.
You little rascal, you! You little rascal, you!